You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 6th of April 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, from South Korea to South Africa, it has been a bad week or so for former national leaders convicted or accused of abusing their position. But does that actually mean it's been a good week or so for democracy? My guests Ben Ryland, Marcus Hippie and Matt Alagaya will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the likely re-election of Viktor Orban in Hungary and what that might mean for modern European populism, satire and politics, and what we might have learned from this week's Monocle 24 series on the relationship between the two, and is there ever a good reason to dress up as a Nazi? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. Welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Monocle's Ben Ryland, Matt Alagaya and Marcus Hippie. Welcome all. First of all, it is tempting when any head of government ends up spending their retirement in the clink to bemoan it as symptomatic of a rotten political culture. There's a counter-argument, however, that it's actually indicative of a robust democracy, a system in which nobody is above the law, not even the top lawmaker. Former South Korean President Park Geun-hye has been given 24 years to reflect on this irony, and in related news, Brazilian ex-president Lula has this week been told he can't delay his sentence to run for re-election. Recently unhorsed South African president Jacob Zuma has found himself in the dock, and former French president Nicolas Sarkozy has been told he will stand trial for corruption. Matt, first of all, it's obviously not ideal that these people are doing the wrong thing in the first place, but it's actually quite historically unusual and quite historically encouraging that people who once occupied these positions are being held accountable.
Absolutely. I mean, it's interesting, that idea of is it good news or is it bad news? I mean, these cases have all been going on for so many years. It's worth bearing that in mind. You know, I think they've all come to a head this week, and it's a bit of a freak accident, really. But I mean, I think it's an interesting point. I mean, with Brazil and South Africa, certainly you can compare those two. The other two are maybe slightly different cases, but with those two, I think it is a really positive thing. I mean, you know, South Africa, although there is a lot of corruption, and Jacob Zuma was very corrupt for a very long time, this shows that actually there are institutions in the country that are incredibly independent and quite fierce. I mean, you look at the judiciary in South Africa, and you look at and the press as well. There's a very vibrant, strong press there. I think both of those two institutions have been absolutely key in bringing him to account for this alleged corruption. And I think the same is true in Brazil. You know, they have this incredibly strong judiciary, which has been able to do this, even though power is held and money is held as well in the hands of very few people.
Ben, Matt makes the point that quite a lot of these cases have rumbled on for ages, particularly the case of Jacob Zuma. I don't think there's anybody terrifically surprised that he's ended up in a position that he's in. Is it weird that it does seem possible, if you do it with a sufficient degree of shamelessness, to pull this stuff off in plain sight for years and years and years and years? I mean, it's good that you get caught up with eventually. But again, it's just, I mean, everybody knew this about Jacob Zuma in particular.
Yeah, I think a lot of this has to do with where it's happening as well. And I think we're looking at this from a global perspective, of course, because it is happening now. All of these people have been caught up in various different scandals in all pockets of the globe. But I think the repercussions are very specific to what kind of culture you have committed these sorts of acts in. And there are certain populations who have, sadly enough and for various different reasons, have become a little bit more accustomed to this. I mean, corruption, of course, has a very different meaning when you go to Brazil at the moment, because it's just become so commonplace. And the more common it is, the more difficult it is to weed it out of the system. It becomes so entrenched, and voters start to just not only expect it, but actually accept it as well. And that's the hardest part. And I do think that when you look at the reaction that we've seen in South Korea, I do detect a certain degree of wariness amongst the political spectrum there and the authorities, that they know that this is a certain kind of moment for the nation, and they need to make a very big example of just how bad this was so that the nation can recover and move on. And I at least I hope that's true.
Marcus, does it seem weird to you that it is actually possible to tempt people in these positions to the kind of things of which these people are being accused or have been convicted? Because this is what always seems to me, weird to me. What else do you want? I mean, you're running an entire country. That presumably comes with quite a nice place to live. A public servant's wage is perhaps not phenomenal, but unless you do something really stupid, you're never going to starve. I mean, it's a pretty sweet setup.
I know, but maybe at the same time there are so many opportunities to be a little bit corrupt. You work with the same people and you think that if you do just this small favour to this person, then, you know, that's a nice thing to do and he or she is going to be feeling better about me, and then someone else is offering a favour to you. And I guess that's how the whole thing begins. It's small favours to start with, and then before you realise, you go deeper and deeper into this, and then in the end, you are in court.
Does anybody have a particular favourite disgraced politician?
Francois Fillon. I thought he just seems to be one of the people on this list of potentially corrupt people who doesn't seem to really understand what he did wrong. If you look at his reactions all the way through it, he's never really come to grips with exactly what the big problem was all along.
I don't know if favourite is the right word, but I remember
it's almost certainly
it,
not.
It wasn't really about corruption, but disgraced politicians. I'm still recalling Rob Ford from Toronto. Very confusing for everyone what was happening over there. We were following that story on Monocle 24 as well. This Toronto mayor who was caught smoking crack, for example. That story didn't sadly end well, but did
remarkable,
make massive headlines and actually gave
images.
People quite a different idea of Toronto.
I would like to give a shout out to a character from mine and Ben's homeland. This is Russ Hinds, the former Queensland minister, or the minister for everything, as he was known, because he did hold a great many portfolios during the strange state premiership was the word I wanted of Joe Bjelke-Petersen.
Queensland.
Yes. Yes, we're entitled to make those superior noises as a Victorian and a New South Welshman.
I was going to say something, but I decided not to.
Matt, do you have any particular favourites?
I mean, Berlusconi is always up there, isn't he? Although he's now gone up full circle from disgrace back to actually a viable politician, apparently.
Oh, I think he's managing to pull off both at the same time.
Yeah, remarkable feat. Yeah,
he is extraordinary. But again, he is the illustration of how this starts and where this ends. It's a complete shamelessness, isn't it?
Absolutely. I'm actually wondering, I wonder if you guys have ever been in the situation that, you know, someone would be asking you a slightly awkward favour, and then you would feel like returning that favour, kind of like that's how corruption begins.
I've been working with you here, Marcus Hippie, for quite a while now, so yes, a fairly daily occurrence, I'm afraid.
According to Marcus Hippie, it's politeness mostly that leads to corruption then.
Well, it's returning a favour. An interesting moral lesson for our listeners to take away. Thank you for that, Marcus.
So no worries. The
lesson...
More
there,
tips to come later.
The lesson there is never help anybody and never cooperate.
But you know, actually, I'm thinking about how to fight against corruption. Maybe one of the reasons why corruption is so common is that the measures you need to take to fight corruption can be a bit uncomfortable. For example, in my native Finland, it's been ranked as one of the least corrupt countries in the world. And you know what? Everyone's income information is public. I can make a phone call and find out how much you earn, Andrew, if you are living in Finland. Same with you other guys. And it's not a nice idea always. My income salary was released once in a Finnish newspaper, and I hated that. But at the same time, that's the argument, that when you know how much money people are earning, it makes the whole system more transparent, and
Norway
less corruption.
Norway does the same thing, doesn't it?
Would you be up for that?
No.
Matt?
I'm not sure that would work here. I don't know. It's interesting. I mean, I think people are very, very cagey in the UK about how much they earn. You know, you never talk about it in the pub or anything like that. And I wonder whether that would just not work in the UK if you tried to publish it.
Why wouldn't it work?
Well, because I think there'd be such outcry against it. I mean, it's something that we don't like talking about, and we certainly wouldn't want.
Yeah, I mean, Marcus, you don't need to give the British another reason to hate each other.
I guess so.
But there's a questions, Andrew, over different levels of corruption as well. And I'm reminded of a case in the state of New South Wales in Australia where...
Careful.
There was...
these are my people, Ben.
It's quite amusing that there were reports of a bottle of Penfold's Grange being gifted to the state premier.
Grangegate.
And he'd forgotten about this particular gift until a thank you note was surfaced, saying that he had not only received the bottle of wine, but he'd written a thank you note in return. And that was considered such an icon of corruption that he ended up having to resign.
Okay, well, let's move along now and take a look at Hungary, which votes on Sunday in parliamentary elections. Barring some aberration extraordinary, even by the standards of recent extraordinary aberrations, Fidesz will win a handy majority, which will mean the perpetuation of the prime ministership of Viktor Orban, who has run, as he usually does, on a platform constructed of bellicose nativism, self-pitying paranoia, and the kind of anti-Semitism which cannot even be bothered to disguise itself. His return to office will do little to dent his confidence or the admiration for him among Europe's cranky nationalist right. Marcus, is he likely to become a bigger noise as a result of this re-election? Is he going to become more of a figurehead for populists and right-wingers across the continent?
I think he's going to be more self-confident, at least. He's already quite a hero for many right-wing movements around Europe. And is he going to get worse? I don't really know how much worse he could actually get, considering what he's been doing in Hungary for quite a few years now. It's interesting how he's exerting his power on so many levels. For example, when it comes to Hungarian cultural institutions, he has been naming his people to be in charge of them. So basically, if you even follow what's happening in the cultural world of Hungary at the moment, there's a lot of that right-wing, anti-immigrant tone, voice going on over there at the moment. I was reading from a newspaper the other day also that even school textbooks are now writing about how Viktor Orban feels about migration. Supposedly, the textbooks conclude that it's not always easy for people from different parts of the world to live together, and that's why Viktor Orban is so anti-migration. So basically, it almost sounds like he's trying to brainwash the whole nation, and I think that's extremely concerning. At the same time, obviously, Hungary isn't the only example of Central or East European nations that have been anti-migration, but it's possibly one of the worst examples of that, though.
I mean, Ben, as one of my fellow Australians, there's a certain amount of Viktor Orban's rhetoric which may sound familiar to you, specifically his slogan, "No one will tell us who we let into our own house." This obviously has echoes of John Howard's, "We will decide who comes here and the circumstances in which they come." The trouble is, there isn't really a pro-immigration message that resonates like that, is there? Because that is, I mean, obviously, where Orban says it is coming from a fairly unsavoury place, but it's actually kind of hard to argue with.
Well, I think it's clever phrasing, isn't it? Because to use your example of the way John Howard put it back in the 90s, it's at that phrase not many people would argue with, because of course every country wants to decide who comes to their country and under and the circumstances in which they come. But the argument is that we should allow more people and that we should be open-minded. Not necessarily allow more people, but be more open-minded about who we allow in and basically be generous people, be compassionate as a population. And I think the difficulty comes when you've got people like Viktor Orban who are using that style of rhetoric as a way of clamping down on all migration and to turn the country into some sort of to close all of the borders off, build walls. And we are at a time in Europe where that's exactly what the continent doesn't need, because we've got countries like Greece, like Italy, who are having to bear the brunt of these sorts of things. And Viktor Orban is the kind of leader who is shutting their doors off to that argument as well. And it goes in complete contradiction to where the European Union is trying to get more cooperation and more unity on these issues.
Matt, how big a challenge does a re-elected and therefore further invigorated Viktor Orban pose to the rest of the European Union? Because it's that weird thing, isn't it? Obviously, I suspect the rest of the EU is not delighted by him, but the more they crack down on him, the more they try and keep him corralled. That just plays into his narrative, doesn't it?
Totally. So he's in this great position, basically, where he has the support of his people and he has the support of the Visegrad nations as well. So this is the kind of group of four sort of Eastern Central European powers, the Czech Republic, Poland and Slovakia as well. And he's a bit of a figurehead for them. They all vote in this similar way in the European Union. They all have broadly sort of populist governments in power. And the trouble is, the EU is weak, and someone like Viktor Orban knows that. And he knows that he can kind of play the EU off against Russia. So if the EU clamps down on him, he can say, well, look, I'll go and have a meeting with Putin, or, you know, he can turn it against them. And I think he knows that on all fronts, really, the EU at the moment is under threat, and so he knows that he's kind of in a strong position, and the EU's in a pretty weak position.
It sounds like that's what's left of the Iron Curtain and the Soviet influence in Central and Eastern Europe. When you look at how the European Union is so divided when it comes to countries that have been or are a bit more pro-migration, and then many of these countries, for example, those Visegrad nations you mentioned over there that are very anti-migration. It's very clear, like, I do understand that Eastern European mentality and philosophy to a certain extent, they've been influenced for so long by another power, and they kind of want to have their own control. They kind of want to have their own, like, you know, they want to have it all for themselves at the moment. They're slightly afraid of foreign influence. And I think it's interesting that the Baltic nations, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, haven't been fighting against migration so much. I've been traveling there a fair bit. I would imagine that they would want to on some level, but at the same time, they need Brussels. They really need the European Union at the moment because they're so worried about what Russia is going to be doing.
I think one thing to also sort of add to that is that it's not just an Eastern European problem. I mean, we look at somewhere like Austria, which now has a very nationalist government in power. Even Germany, we've seen the growth of the AfD, which is the Alternative for Deutschland. You know, that is an incredibly right-wing party. And all of these parties, you know, these are in Western European powers. And that's another thing that's making the European Union much weaker, is the fact that they have populists within their own countries, even in sort of a place like Germany, which is supposedly the heart of the EU.
I mean, is there a way that the EU could perhaps corral him by reacting not so much to Hungary in general as him personally, if it was just made clear that his behaviour and his rhetoric is beyond the pale in terms of how a civilised European leader should talk?
I think you've got to tread very, very carefully there, because if you just look at all of the reactions that the world has to when there's bad behaviour from Russia, all it does is strengthen Vladimir Putin. And if there's one thing clear about Viktor Orban, it's that he models himself after Vladimir Putin. And any degree in which you can present Viktor Orban as some sort of enemy of European Union values is only going to strengthen what he's built up as the foundation of his leadership. There is this idea that the European Union encroaches on national sovereignty. And it has some echoes, I think, of the paranoia in the United States over gun laws. And, you know, the government is coming to take away your guns. And in Hungary and in any sort of country that has a lot of EU, a lot of doubts over the EU's legitimacy, there is this fear that the European Union is coming to take something away from us, to take away our national identity. And that's why I think building up borders is always a vote winner when you're talking to a people like that.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, along with Matt Alagaya, Ben Ryland and Marco Sippi. Coming up next, a reflection on what we learned from this week's series on politics and satire.
The Monocle Quality of Life Conference returns, and this year we're touching down in Zurich. Join Monocle's editors and a lineup of tack-sharp panellists for lively debate, informed conversation and top-notch hospitality. Whether you're an architect, city maker, retailer, media mogul or chef, pick up a ticket and be part of the debate on upping quality of life across the board. Why not join us from the 28th to the 30th of June? Find out more and book your ticket now at conference.monocle.com.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Miller. Still with me are Marco Sippi, Matt Alagaya and Ben Ryland. Now, if you've been listening to Monocle 24 this week, and of course you have, you will possibly have heard one or more episodes of this week's series looking at political satire. One of the questions raised by any such contemplation is the one of whether satire is, as it prefers to believe it is, a valuable weapon in the fight against apathy and decadence, or whether in fact it contributes to both of those forms of ennui by encouraging the belief that politics is corrupt and venal and politicians bent or incompetent. Ben, you produced this farrago this week. Where did you end up feeling on this one? Is satire part of the problem or part of a solution?
It's both, confusingly enough. And I do think we need to draw a line here between political comedy and political satire, because we have a lot of this is in the news at the moment because of the return of the sitcom Roseanne, which has put comedy and politics in some sort of somewhat awkward conflation into the many of the headlines. That, of course, is not making fun of politics so much, but is using politics as a way to make jokes and make people laugh. laugh. Political satire, on the other hand, is when we actually take a satirical jab at the concept of politics and really try to take politicians down a peg or two, or maybe all the way. And I think there is a bit of an argument for some satire taking some of the air out of what politics is supposed to be. I would never say that satire bears more of the blame than politicians themselves. I do think that we have...
The politicians have to give the satirists the material to work with.
Exactly. And when you have, when you're living in an age where the Prime Minister will do something, you know, as blasé as call a referendum on European Union membership and then hum as he walks through his own front door, you know... It's kind of, it's baiting the satirist. It's really asking them to do their job. So I don't think that they're bearing the brunt here. But, you know, there is some degree of argument that would suggest that when we've got people who are so disinterested in politics that the only exposure they have to it is by tuning into satire, it can build up this impression that politics is only funny, that politics isn't important, that somehow voting doesn't really matter, and you can make reckless voting choices based purely on self-interest, because heck, it doesn't even matter at the end of the day anyway. Well, I don't think that is true. I do think real politics in the real world does matter, and we should be able to draw a line between those two things.
Hey, Matt, what do you think? Is there an issue here? Does satire, and there is a lot of it, and I'm sure there are many people who construct their view of politics more or less entirely from it, because it's easier to understand, it's glib, it's entertaining, it's funny, and so forth. But does it encourage a widespread belief that politics is fundamentally unserious?
I don't know about that. I mean, I think certainly satire has the capability to make all politicians look terrible. I mean, one thing I've been thinking about when we were sort of preparing for this discussion, I kind of thought in the UK we definitely have a lower caliber of politician, I would say, across the board than we've had in a very, very long time. And I wonder whether that is partly because people aren't going into politics anymore or not in the same numbers, and whether that is partly because actually you are just relentlessly poked fun at for your entire life if you're a public official. And I wonder whether that is actually a problem more generally that we're, you know, I'll talk about this country because I think I know it best, but we're so kind of horrible to our politicians, often with very good reason.
Britain more so than most countries, I think.
Right. And I think, you know, I wonder whether that actually leads to people not going into it who maybe should, you know, people who are perhaps a little bit less, you know, more timid perhaps, don't go into politics because they're worried about being sort of bullied constantly. And satire is part of that.
But then again, politicians are supposed to be strong enough to actually be able to face strong criticism. And I think if you have journalists after you kind of like, you know, checking what you've been doing and, you know, making sure that, you know, the decisions you have been making have been fair. I think like, you know, a nasty drawing or, you know, like, you know, someone imitating you on a TV show is not much compared to that.
If you can't handle the journalist, how do you handle Vladimir
Putin,
for example?
I suppose that's true. But I guess, you know, we don't only do that with the Prime Minister. I mean, we go down to sort of junior politicians, junior ministers, and we poke fun at them. But I think, you know, it's very personal in the UK. We're not just talking about people's policies and decisions they've made that affect people outside of the Houses of Parliament. We're also, you know, taking the piss out of how they speak and what they look like and things like that. And I don't know whether that necessarily is good for politics.
There was an interesting debate that popped up that I think speaks to that, Matt, in Australia a little while ago, not too long ago, with the Deputy Prime Minister Barnaby Joyce, who, of course, is not the Deputy Prime Minister anymore because he was found to be having an affair with one of his former staffers. And up until that point, the personal lives of politicians had never been reported on by the newspapers.
I mean, we should make the point that there'd been a period in which he'd had to stop being Deputy Prime Minister because we found out he was actually a New Zealander, which I think was the biggest scandal.
Well, that wasn't the one that cost him his job. But the Daily Telegraph, which is a tabloid newspaper, a Murdoch paper in Sydney, it decided to break that taboo and reported on his private life. And there was a lot of concern amongst the media in Australia that this would irreparably change the media landscape. And a lot of the senior editors from newspapers around the country were using Britain as the example of the kind of media that Australia should not become.
I mean, is this a thing in Finland, Marcus? Is there a huge tradition of political satire making fun of Finnish politicians and Finnish politics?
I think there is a massive market gap for that. There isn't. There isn't. There isn't.
Steady on with massive.
There isn't. Well, yeah. There isn't much of that going on over there. One or two newspapers. But it's interesting that there's been a few scandals in Finland recently that have made it very clear that Finnish politicians, you know, prime minister and, like, you know, the government, they are quite sensitive to these things. There's been incidents when the prime minister, for example, has been making phone calls to the head of the Finnish broadcasting company News and complaining about the coverage and all that. I think Finnish politicians deserve more criticism. They deserve more satire and all that. I think they are being treated a bit too nicely over there, and I think it wouldn't do harm to have, you know, a nasty television show.
We need a Finnish Veep.
Exactly.
Okay, well, finally tonight, and that is a mind-blowing thought. There is a Finnish character in Veep, of course.
Of course,
really?
Sally Phillips, isn't it, who plays a former Finnish Prime Minister called Häkkinen.
I smell a spin-off.
a name they have doubtless filched from the two-time Formula One world champion of that name. But finally tonight, to the Yorkshire settlement of Levisham, which for the last 12 years has let its railway station be appropriated as part of a World War II-themed weekend, which naturally involves the presence of people dressed up as the other team. Not this year, however. The regular group of Wehrmacht reenactors have been disinvited to forestall a repeat of certain negative press coverage the event attracted last year. I've never been to an event at which anybody has dressed up as Nazis. The band I play in did a few years ago play at a country music festival in Monmouthshire, at which there were lots of people dressed up as rebel soldiers of the Confederacy, which was pretty weird, driving into this beautiful, lambent Welsh valley and seeing the stars and bars flying from horizon to horizon and people selling each other Nathan Forrest coffee mugs. It's a weird thing to want to do, I think.
I don't know any people who want to dress up as Nazis, and I find it a bit funny if I knew some people. Why do you want to do that? And why do you want to reenact these things? I do understand. I think it very much depends on what your motivation is. I think if you are an actor, for example, you go on stage,
you're doing a job.
Exactly. But if you just want to spend a weekend dressed up as a Nazi, there is something in the background.
I have to say, I do think we're doing a bit of... it's a bit of a disservice to Mr. Neil Robertson, who was involved in designing these scenarios, because his defence is that this isn't just we're all standing around having a bit of fun. His defence is that this is an educational situation, that he's designed an actual scenario. You could almost describe it as immersive theatre, I suppose, in some ways.
Indeed, you could. No, I mean, we should be clear on this, that it was a very serious and thought through and doubtless well-intentioned thing. But the thing is that even so, somebody has to want to dress up as a Nazi.
Well, of course, but, you know, someone had to want to dress up as a Nazi to make Schindler's List. You don't do it because you get your kicks out of it. You do it because it's history. You're trying to make people remember that this actually happened, give people an appreciation. And I think, it would be very different to see this happening in front of you, to be actually immersed in this scene that looks exactly or very close to what it would have been like during the Second World War. It would be different to just simply watching it on the screen, I think. I don't think it's entirely bad.
I mean, I kind of feel like the conversation should be about whether historical reenactment is a thing that we should be doing. Because surely if you think that historical reenactment is not a good thing, but a thing that it's okay to happen, then you kind of have to have both sides, don't you? You can't just have everyone dressed up as British, you know, British Tommies, and then that be your historical reenactment. I think it's fair to have both sides. I think it's a much more interesting question why anyone would want to do historical reenactment.
Exactly, but
this is Yorkshire.
I'd also would like to know how this discussion went when they were when they were sharing out the roles. Was there a massive competition to be British, or were there quite a few guys who actually very voluntarily wanted to be Nazis in this reenactment?
I do understand that there is the same group that fulfills the Nazi roles each year, and they were told after the outcry of last year that they would not be invited back anymore. When it was only just recently that the entire group had released a statement saying that due to the media outcry, they blamed the media squarely for being irresponsible in their coverage. So they have not admitted that it was in poor taste or anything. They've blamed the media for not representing the true intentions of their reenactment.
God, it's always us, isn't it? Have any of you ever partaken in any sort of historical reenactment of anything?
Yes.
I haven't.
Do go on, Ben. You have about 20 seconds.
I was forced to in school, and unfortunately, we were forced to reenact. I'm sorry, I actually don't remember the details of the exact historical episode
that
I was reenacting.
By it.
Look, I'll just say this now. My history lessons in Australia's education system of the 90s were not exactly second to none. I don't recall what I was reenacting, but I do remember dressing up in a costume from somewhere around the colonial period and marching down the main street of my hometown.
Well, that piquant thought brings us to the end of today's show. Ben Ryland, Matt Alagaya and Marcus Hippie, thank you for joining us at Midori House. The show was produced by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Augustin Macellari. Research by Pierre-Antoine Denis, and our studio manager was David Stevens. Music next at 1900. Marcus is back with The Menu. There's more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time on Monday, 1800 London. Until then, have a great weekend. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.